America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. Sure, we've made incredible leaps forward in medicine over the last century. Who can deny that? Yet it doesn't seem as if we are much better at predicting or handling public health emergencies. Can anyone honestly say that the federal response to COVID-19 gives you great confidence that the next germ is something we can meet head-on before heading into a social and economic abyss? Often on this podcast, we go back to look at how we've arrived at this place so we can project where we go in the future. Look, headlines in 2020 about COVID don't look all that different from the stories in 1918 and what has become known as Spanish influenza. The more things change, let's discuss whether we might go forward with greater awareness and confidence of what's next as to our health and safety. Today on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Martin Hallowell, and he's a professor of American Studies at the University of Leicester in England. And I've got to ask you, as a professor of American Studies, what's it like? What are people thinking about the American experiment in the UK these days?
Well, it's a timely time to speak to you, Larry, and thanks so much for having me on. With the G7 summit happening in Cornwall at the moment, so it'll be the first time that President Biden has met the UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson. And it seems that they've got off to a reasonably good start. We'd hope, particularly with the theme of the environment, that there'd be both on the US side a recommitment to the Paris Agreement, which obviously President Trump was reluctant to stay with, but also on the British side, I think, particularly with the experience of Brexit over the last couple of years, a commitment to thinking about planetary and global matters rather than strictly national ones. So I think, you know, environmental crises and the kinds of health crises I document in my book come together, as President Biden has said. Often crises collide or overlap, and even though the COVID crisis is waning slightly for our two countries, it's still a global crisis. And I think a commitment to the COVAX scheme, which would be committing vaccines across the globe, particularly to countries that lack the infrastructure to develop and distribute their own, is a major commitment and one that needs to be across the G7 nations and beyond.
Your book is called American Health Crisis, 100 Years of Panic, Planning, and Politics. And just so people have an understanding of when you wrote this book, you started it in 2015. You finished just as COVID-19 was beginning to impact the United States. How closely did the pandemic play out in the U.S. and following the pattern that you document in your book?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, there are clear differences between COVID and previous viral epidemics. One of the chapters of the book looks at three major epidemics, the influenza pandemic of 1918-19, which was obviously global as well as very much national for the US, looking at polio, which begins in the late 19th century and goes through to the vaccine rollout in the 1950s, a series of episodic crises, and then the HIV-AIDS crisis, which begins in the late 1970s. At least that's when the first cases come to light in the US. And then my study goes through to the early 1990s, but of course HIV is still very much a critical condition for many developing nations. In terms of COVID, there are similarities, particularly with the influenza pandemic. It's virtually 100 years since that hit the shores of the US. But there are differences as well. I think the transmissibility of COVID is different from previous viral epidemics, and its mutability as well. You'll know that the World Health Organization has just renamed the various variants or mm-hmm. mutations of COVID to try and destigmatize them. So the UK variant is the Alpha variant, the Indian variant is Delta. And I think that's interesting because often stigma attaches itself to a crisis. We saw in the 1910s, the influenza pandemic was misnamed the Spanish flu, and that was largely because Spain was a neutral country during World War One, so reported on it in ways that Germany and France and the UK and the US didn't, and the name stuck. So I think issues around stigma and scapegoating is something that's continuous. The arc of COVID is a difficult one. And I finished the first draft of the book thinking that my final crisis would be the opioid crisis, which was starting to crest when I was first working on the book and obviously hit a critical point during the Trump administration. But I had to deal with COVID, and the danger of dealing with contemporary history, of course, is that it can sometimes take an unexpected turn or head into a longer trajectory than we could see at the time. So my book in the coda and at various points deals with 10 months of the COVID pandemic to around October. And I think if I could look back on the book and redraft it now, I think there'd be more on racial justice with respect to COVID. You know, the phrase "we're all in it together" suggests a kind of level playing field. I think the disparities amongst different demographics have become more starkly apparent in the last 10 months rather than the first 10 months. And also the issue of leadership as well. I focus on Anthony Fauci, an obvious leader in not just navigating us through the first year or so of an unprecedented pandemic crisis, but also he offers continuity because Fauci was an important figure in NIH during the late 80s and early 90s, conversing with HIV activists when they were largely scapegoated by the government or ignored, but also working with the Surgeon General to switch away from thinking about AIDS in a stigmatizing way to thinking about how you could tackle a virus. So the language shifted very much from AIDS to HIV. And Fauci had a big influence on that.
In your book, you do try to figure out what it is that American presidents contribute to health success or crisis. And, of course, you focus on Woodrow Wilson going back to 1918. Then you go forward to LBJ and some of the reforms that he made. And I'm just wondering, when you do look at the COVID crisis, and you look at Donald Trump's leadership during it, and then you look at the way that we divided as a country over the issue of masks and such. Did that surprise you?
Yes, in some ways. I didn't think about the politicization of masking until COVID. So the cover image from the book was an image that was recently discovered, taken by an Oakland amateur photographer in 1918, and it's a group of Californians wearing masks. That started to, as an image, started to circulate in the media in early 2020. And very much looking back at that image from a 100-year perspective, particularly with the very partisan politics of masking, is it about infringement of civil liberties, or is it about care of others? Certainly, I think there's an inflection point for thinking about what happened 100 years before. I don't think anyone expected that masks would be so politicized. They're commonly worn in Southeast Asia, since SARS particularly, but even before that. But I think in both Western Europe and the United States, you know, there was both a need for masks, but also reluctance. But the other thing to say, of course, that health advice does evolve. So there's still a debate about whether one mask or two is better in terms of reducing transmissibility. There's also, a divided opinion on whether hand sanitation and contaminated surfaces is a vector for COVID, or whether it's just through breath and breathing.
But I want to ask you, I want to get back to the whole idea of a president's role, because, for example,
sure,
you're saying that LBJ in the 60s was so important, it was the zenith of the federal government's moral responsibility to the nation's health. And, of course, you're teaching about American studies in the UK. The National Health Service there is not something that gets politicized, from what I can tell. It is something that is widely accepted as so vital and important. And yet in the United States, health policy is so fractious, and we really haven't moved that far forward since the 1960s.
Yeah, it's a very important distinction between our two countries. I guess the closest thing to the NHS would be the Veterans Administration, which is a kind of welfare notion of health. Aside from that, it's quite starkly different from the UK, but also other countries like Canada and other European countries. In terms of the presidency, I think, and what I try and do in the book, is look at the Lyndon Johnson presidency as one where the moral commitment to the health of the nation was taken most seriously. There's a caveat there in the sense that most of Johnson's most progressive reforms, particularly Medicare and Medicaid, happened in his first couple of years, clearly with escalation in Vietnam and with increasing concern about overspending on domestic matters. There was a tailing off or a scaling down of those kinds of reforms later in the Johnson presidency. But one of the themes of the book, going back to the theme of leadership, would be moral leadership, particularly when it comes to the health of the nation. And the cards tend to fall favorably towards the Democrats in that respect. But I also point out in the book that Democratic administrations aren't necessarily those that can ameliorate a crisis or predict a crisis any more than Republicans. It's just that the idea of caring for the nation tends to be more closely aligned to the rhetoric of Democratic politics than Republican. But the Johnson administration, I did quite a lot of research in the LBJ library, is certainly the midpoint historically of the book, but also I think a really important moment for thinking about what it means to care for such a large and diverse nation. The danger, of course, is that you can overspend. And although the book looks at both the rhetoric and reality of crises rather than going too far towards looking at the economics of health, of course, the two sides are always entangled.
What about the underpinnings of America's health system? If you talk to certain people, Professor Hallowell, they'll tell you, well, America has the best medicine because we have a lot of advanced technology and procedures, great doctors. We have a lot of that. But we also have a lot of deficiencies about the delivery system. And our public health system some believe has been exposed as a result of the recent crises, even the opioid and the following on to COVID-19, that we really don't respond terribly well, and that we don't fund things well, and we don't listen well to federal authorities like the CDC, or they don't have a lot of sway. It goes back down to the state level and local public health agencies. So when you look at America and the way overall we deal with crisis, given the context of our healthcare structure, what do you say?
I think you can see it two ways. I think there's a lot of flexibility in the U.S. structure. It's not heavily centralized, although obviously there is both governance and infrastructure that comes from the federal government, but it's not a completely distributed model either. So you could say that it actually works in checks and balances to have both flexibility and a kind of core federal oversight as well. The danger, of course, that you end up with a patchwork system which is neither one thing or another. And that's the kind of language that runs through the 100 years of the book, both when we're thinking about the ramping up of the public health service in the 1910s during the Woodrow Wilson administration, which is where the book starts, through a number of presidencies. Roosevelt uses that language, Jimmy Carter uses that language in the 1970s, and then it was used in federal reports in the early 2000s as well. So a patchwork system is the kind of neither one thing nor the other. I think where the healthcare system has most often shown itself to have systemic weaknesses is in terms of the care for mental, for patients and ex-patients and individuals suffering from mental ill health. And that's one of the areas that I've done most research on. Two books before this looked at therapeutic cultures after World War II and the politicization of mental health from the 1970s to the millennium. And I think particularly with trying to ensure that there's parity of care and provision for mental health conditions as opposed to physical health conditions is something that there are is quite often seen as being in crisis mode. There's not enough, or there's not the right kind, or there's not enough access to, there's too much custodial care, or there's too much community care, or there's perhaps not enough care at all. So I think lurching into crisis mode often has revealed itself historically when it comes to caring for mental health conditions.
The book is called American Health Crisis, 100 Years of Panic, Planning, and Politics. Martin Hollowell is with us to discuss it. Which health crisis has showed America's response at its best, and which perhaps at its worst?
That's a really interesting question. In terms of planning, I think, the Roosevelt administration, I think, trying to move the nation away from both the health crisis side of the Great Depression and the economic side of it was probably the most far-sighted. But having said that, Roosevelt developed welfare system side of things much more coherently than the healthcare side of things. It was still unfinished business for him, and Harry Truman tried to pass a major legislation in the 1940s, failed to get it through Congress. It was certainly unfinished business for Roosevelt. It's interesting that Biden has been compared with Roosevelt or some of his infrastructural reforms. Again, it's too early to say how they will pan out or whether they'll have congressional approval. But I certainly see a line of continuity, of course, between Roosevelt and Johnson, potentially Biden, and in moments, both Carter and Clinton as well. On the other side, I think where the U.S. has learned the least is probably in response to floods and natural disasters. Hmm. For the first chapter of the book, which I call Disaster, looks at the Great Mississippi Flood of the late 1920s in the Coolidge administration. And then it moved on to looking at a smaller, lesser known flood in West Virginia, in mining county near the Kentucky border, called the Buffalo Creek Flood from 1972 during the Nixon administration. And then to the probably the most obvious disaster, Hurricane Katrina in 2005, during the Bush, George W. Bush years. And although you can't simply say that they're the same kind of flood, the Mississippi flood affected a major region, not just in the Delta, but up into to Illinois as well. And the Buffalo Creek flood was a community flood, which was quite localized, but still devastating. And obviously Hurricane Katrina hit New Orleans really hard, but also the Mississippi Gulf Coast.
And what I think there is, do you think America's federal system suggests that, well, depending upon where you are, and because you do talk a lot about geography and response to health crisis, and depending upon how powerful you are or who's affected, that the response is different in America based upon various of those attributes?
To a degree, certainly. I think it's not just geography from Washington, but certainly I think with the Buffalo Creek flood, which was largely ignored by the Nixon administration. There was some mining improvement acts that went through in the 1970s because there was a series of mining disasters in the late 60s onwards. But Nixon goes on record about Hurricane Agnes, but doesn't really mention the Buffalo Creek flood at all. So sometimes it's neglect. Sometimes it's passing the buck. So who's going to take responsibility or blame for a disaster? And often there's a kind of shifting of sands in terms of ultimate responsibility. I think the other thing to be said, and this is why I think the Great Mississippi Flood of the 20s is really important, is that Coolidge was very reluctant to both act immediately, but also put himself in the line of sight. So rather than going to the South, he sends Herbert Hoover, his Commerce Secretary, to work with the Red Cross to provide aid and development in the South. So I think Coolidge's reluctance was a reluctance to set a precedent, which would mean that every future administration would have to act immediately once a disaster or crisis hits. So I think that theme is a very common one, and we see it with Trump, certainly with Hurricane Maria, and he seemed to be goaded into going to Puerto Rico, and then he only went to San Juan very briefly rather than actually spending time in the disaster site. And another instance is George W. Bush flying over New Orleans and taking a few critical days to really involve himself and the administration in disaster relief.
It'll be very interesting to see over the years with the effects of climate change, whether that type of response does change and we get better at that. What kind of political struggle was it to get things like the Centers for Disease Control or the National Institutes of Health? I don't think that most Americans thought about those agencies a whole lot until the COVID epidemic. So tell us what you think this might suggest about us going forward, whether we need another planning mechanism, whether we need a more federal oversight, and whether this particular crisis might lead us in that direction.
Well, again, going back to that notion of patchwork, I think it works on in a positive way in terms of thinking about the Department of Health and Human Services, which has a number of agencies or units, the National Institutes of Health being the most famous, obviously, in just outside D.C., Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, based in Atlanta. Both NIH and CDC have got a rich and important history behind them, a series of name changes for CDC, a series of expansions for NIH. And it's interesting, for example, 2010, NIH added a new institute to focus on minority health and health disparities, which was a clear sense in 2010 that NIH and health infrastructure at the federal level wasn't paying enough attention to minority issues, which along with rural communities are the least served medically or in terms of healthcare access in the US. So there is recognition. Often it comes slightly too late to prevent a crisis, or there's a series of misalignments with working with other agencies. And Johnson, going back to the LBJ years, was very keen to ensure that agencies and departments and the federal government spoke to each other. And I think that notion of coordination is vital. But CDC and NIH certainly have come to, you know, major national and international attention in the last year or so. But they do do valuable research work, and not just in the US. I think it's really important to think about health beyond borders, and both of those institutions can help us to do that when things seem to becoming increasingly nationalistic. I think it's important to rely both on robust national institutes speaking to others elsewhere in the world, and also refracted through WHO as well.
Does the world think that America, with a lot of leadership in health technology and health breakthroughs, does the world look upon us as being responsive to the global needs? I know that in the follow-up now to the pandemic, we're beginning to contribute significant amounts of vaccine, but some say not enough. Does America really need to lead in that response diplomatically?
I think so, diplomatically, but technologically as well. I think there are two aspects there. And I look at the work and thoughts of Robert Bella, the University of California sociologist, in the book. And Bella both calls for moral leadership, but also thinking about a very inclusive notion of health citizenship, which is about care of your community and being an active citizen within your community, but also thinking beyond it as well, which could be, you know, thinking about your neighbors, but also neighboring countries. I think it becomes even more important. Maybe it becomes more of a necessity rather than a moral imperative to think about the way in which epidemics cross borders, whether it's COVID or Zika or SARS. So there's a moral dimension, but there's also a strategic one as well to do that. The other side of it, I think, is technology. And we've seen with the development of mobile health apps or telehealth, the way in which doctors can and nurses can speak to patients living in disaster zones when they may be out of reach, but also the fact that health, if it's dealt with appropriately, can reach out through technology. The danger, of course, is that particularly social media can fan rumor and panic as much as it can offer helpful health advice. So there is a caveat there that technology can sometimes be the answer, but not always. And if you have a absence of moral leadership, it can sometimes, you know, be the devil rather than the angel when it comes to thinking about how we move forward in a less critical response mode.
The Affordable Care Act, which came about, of course, in the 21st century, very controversial at its inception. What kind of move forward was that? Was the Affordable Care Act put forward in response to an American health crisis, or just weaknesses in our structure, or just an ongoing debate that goes on, where the right talks about more deregulation and market choice? And in your book, you say that crisis of late capitalism has been a key to recent health crisis in the U.S. Help us to understand where the Affordable Care Act falls in terms of its response and to what.
The ACA can be seen as a compromise. I don't think it was quite what Obama wanted, but I think we've seen over recent years that it has both expanded healthcare coverage quite dramatically, and it's also something that the American people have become used to. So it became, you know, the key issue in the 2018 midterms, and there was a lot of worry, not just amongst Democrats, but across the whole country, in terms of what plan the Trump administration had to replace the Affordable Care Act, that there didn't seem to be one. So it's become very quickly part. I mean, we're looking back over 10 years now, so it's perhaps not so quickly. It's become very much part of the healthcare substructure in the same way that Medicare and Medicaid has. Interestingly, Edward Kennedy, who's one figure that I deal with on a number of occasions in the book, who worked through a number of administrations, who was talking about the crisis of healthcare in the late 1960s and the 1970s, was, if you like, the intellectual figure behind the ACA. He died at a moment where he couldn't see its fulfillment, but there was a kind of handing on to Obama, something he felt that the Clinton administration had failed to do in the 90s, and the Carter administration had failed to do in the late 70s. So I think ACA, we can look back and see glimmers of it in Truman's failed bid to have national health insurance in the late 40s, through Johnson, through Clinton, you know, a series of failed attempts that the ACA actually managed to fulfill. But the flip side of that, it can be seen as you know, not being quite enough. Biden's talked quite a number of times about needing to fix some of the loopholes in ACA, to have perhaps a government-backed policy as well as a series of options. And so there's still controversies at a more local or more granular level with ACA. But I think you might have a different view, Larry, but it's largely, I think, been accepted as something that's necessary, you know, and pushes the US towards a more coordinated system than it has.
Well, do we ever go back? I mean, you do talk in the book about a boomerang effect in which one administration strives to undo the achievements of the previous one. We did see that there were many votes that a Republican-led Senate took over recent years to undo the Affordable Care Act. What do you think is more likely to happen going forward, since we do look at trends in this podcast? Do you think America will take some examples from countries like the UK and Canada as the way to respond to health crisis and to undergird the structure of our healthcare system, as opposed to relying more on a less centralized focus? What do you project based upon your scholarship, because history often foretells the future?
With this, I think there is a danger of saying what I'd like to happen, what would be the right thing to happen, and then saying what will happen, you know, what mm-hmm. history, future history may tell us. And I think there's a danger of trying to predict. But sometimes there's a fine line between the preservation of something and its potential demolition. And we saw with the congressional move to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act, it was John McCain's vote that stood between something that's very different. I don't think, you know, one-term Trump presidency would have brought it in, but without the McCain bucking the Republican whip, and the two-term Trump presidency, there would have been, I would have said, a definite divergence into what we're likely to get over the next decade. So I think that there's sometimes fine lines between one type of historical trajectory and another. I don't think ACA will be dismantled. I think it will have another name. You know, Trump really disliked the fact that it was attached to President Obama's name. So I think the transformation or the morphing of the ACA will be as much at a rhetorical level as one where I think that it will develop into something else rather than a clean sweep to wipe it out. I think there will be a public option. I'm not sure how quickly that will come about, but I think keeping free choice or choice amongst a range of options is actually absolutely essential to the American way, and that couldn't be lost as well. So I don't see the US health care system moving to a European or a British model either.
You do suggest, and I'll close with this, that the health crisis that you have documented so brilliantly in the book, American Health Crisis, provide insights into many of a society's weaknesses and vulnerabilities. What does America's response to the many crises that you have explored, what does it say about the American society?
I think when we're thinking about why there are so many crises, it seems, in the US, I think we have to acknowledge it is a vast and diverse nation. It's harder to centralize in the US. Even if you were ideologically a centrist, it's harder to centralize because of the size and the diversity, not just of its people, but its climate as well. But I think one of the strongest themes of the book is the theme about community. We need to see crises both at the federal level, both in terms of planning, but also government response to critical episodes. But we also need never to forget the experience of a crisis is usually at the level of the individual, the community. So I think without moving towards, you know, a socialist view, which the book doesn't try and put forward at all, I hope it strikes a balance between one that is sees the importance of government as much as it points out the historical failures of certain administrations to respond. But I think the importance of community is America at its best. And I lived in Seattle for a couple of years as a boy. In some ways, I wish I'd continued to live there. But perhaps my view has been sharpened by living in Europe, spending a lot of time in the US over the last 15 years or so, but trying to get close to it, but also keep an eye on what's happening in health trends globally, but also in other nations as well.
Martin Halliwell, I want to thank you for joining us today on America Trends. The book is called American Health Crisis, and he spent many years putting this together. So if you are fascinated by the topic, I don't think you'll find a better compendium than this. Thank you for being with us today.
Thanks so much, Larry. Thank you for having me on.